Hello, my name is John Chung. Thank you for listening to Totally Awesome Films, where I discuss some of the greatest films ever made. Each week I watch a movie, talk about what I thought of the movie, research a little bit about how it got made, and discuss why I think the film is totally awesome. I'd like to warn listeners that this is a spoiler podcast, so if you have not seen the movie and do not want to be spoiled by information presented here, I recommend that you turn off the podcast, watch the movie, and return after you've seen the movie so that you can better enjoy this show. In this podcast, we're going to talk about the third film in the James Bond franchise, the 1964 film Goldfinger. Now, most of my friends who are James Bond fans list this one consistently as one of their favorite films. In fact, I think if you ask any James Bond fan to name their top five films, I think Goldfinger would probably be on almost everyone's list. And even when I saw this in high school at only 14 years old, I could still tell this was a great movie. I grew up in the Roger Moore era of James Bond and Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy. You know, these were my movies that were coming out at the time. And all the grown-ups would tell us that Sean Connery was the better Bond. And after Never Say Never Again, you know, which introduced us to Sean Connery, my friend Noah and I went and we rented a bunch of old Sean Connery films. And out of those, I remember this one being our favorite Connery James Bond film. This movie really had everything. It had humor. It had action. It had a really good balance of the two. You know, when you think about James Bond films, you generally categorize them into two categories. You know, one the very campy and one the very serious. But in many ways, yeah, sure, this does have campy elements, but this really is a very good balanced James Bond movie. It also had a great villain. It had a beautiful femme fatale. It just really had everything, and it really is just a very, very fun movie to watch. So we start the film with James Bond invading the fortress, wearing a duck on his head. But no time for laughs, we're thrown immediately into the action, and the James Bond music starts, and he knocks out a guard, he sets charges to explode in a villain's lair, and then afterwards, he unzips his scuba gear, and he's wearing a flawless tuxedo. He goes to seduce a woman, but it's a double cross, and he's attacked by a heavy, but he lets the girl get hit on the head, and then he throws the heavy into a bathtub and electrocutes him, and then dryly says, "Shocking." And then looking at the woman who betrays him, says again, "Positively shocking." It is the quintessential Bond moment, and it's been homaged and parodied multiple times, including James Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger in the opening of True Lies. And we're off, and the whole movie is just an amazing roller coaster ride. We also get a lot of the final classic James Bond elements, which are finally added in this third installment. Firstly, as mentioned before, we get the standalone pre-credit introductory action sequence. Number two, we get the superhuman henchman. Number three, we get the Pew Branch Laboratory. Four, we get the gadget car in the Aston Martin DB. And five, we get the sexy femme fatale with the dirty name. And all these elements finally congeal in this film, and we see the mold that's going to become the official familiar pattern. Now keep in mind, there's only been three films now. This is completing a trilogy of films, and there really is no formula yet. But now, with this film, we're beginning to see the final pieces of film history getting established. Interestingly, it's this movie where James Bond says his very famous line. You know, what does James Bond drink? He drinks a vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. And it is in this movie where he orders this drink for the first time. Now, there are other memorable motifs unique to this film that have just entered our popular collective unconscious. For example, the opening song, the torture scene involving a laser, the sexy and glamorous pussy galore, the fascinating henchman, Oddjob, and his deadly bowler hat, and of course, the scene with the woman painted in gold. And this is one of the most iconic images, probably not only from the whole James Bond franchise, but arguably from all of pop culture. In fact, the image was so popular that actress Shirley Eaton even graced the cover of Life magazine on November 1964, painted in gold paint. I really think that with this film, they really captured lightning in a bottle. Interestingly, I now think of this movie as the film that made Me, as well as an entire generation, incorrectly believed that being covered in paint could lead to suffocation and death. Well, let me just ask you, is it medically safe for a person to be covered entirely in paint? And of course, most people would say, no, you can suffocate. Well, almost everyone is absolutely surprised to find out that this is not true. It is actually medically safe to be covered in paint. And in fact, in this movie, Bond says she died of skin suffocation. It has been known to happen to cabaret dancers. It's all right as long as you have a bare patch at the base of the spine. And apparently, Ian Fleming just made this up. There have been no instances of cabaret dancers actually having any medical problems because of painting themselves. And leaving a patch of the spine is also, he just made it up for the book. Apparently, this was common medical belief at the time, and we now know that covering the body with paint is relatively safe, and at most can cause mildly elevated blood pressure, mostly probably due to panic and placebo effect. But there really is no medical sequelae of doing that. There is no oxygen transfer that occurs from the skin. However, I totally bought it at the time, and only recently, many years later, after I received my medical training, did I learn that it simply wasn't true. Another Bond staple is introduced here, and that is the gadget car, the Aston Martin DB5. This car has all sorts of really cool gadgets like switching license plates, it has an ejector seat, it has machine guns in the front, it even has a mechanism that sprays oil in case the car is being followed. The car is also equipped with special spikes that come out and destroy wheels, which was in fact inspired by the movie Ben-Hur. Interestingly, these were not the only gadgets that were installed in this car. While they weren't used in the movie, the car also had front and back overriders for jamming other vehicles, it had a weapons tray under the driver's seat, it had a thermos which had a built-in hand grenade, the headlights would also pop up and shoot out triple-spiked nail clusters for firing at enemies, and it also had a radio telephone inside the driver's door paneling. Incidentally, the actual Aston Martin used in this movie was auctioned off in 2010 for a whopping price of $4.1 million. Now, of course, we can't discuss Goldfinger without mentioning the song. The producers apparently gave John Barry complete control over the music, and he ran with it. The song was sung by Shirley Bassey, and it was a complete hit. And it was so popular and so successful that the producers would continue to try to repeat the pattern two more times by using her again, once in Diamonds Are Forever, and again in Moonraker. Finally, another iconic image is James Bond trapped on a torture table, getting ready to be cut in half by a laser, crotch first. And this was added for the film. It isn't in the book. Apparently, when the book was written, lasers didn't exist, and Goldfinger threatens to cut James Bond with a buzzsaw. Lasers were the new thing, and director Guy Hamilton wanted to put this cutting-edge new technology into his film, and he even consulted two Harvard scientists to help design an accurate look and feel of the laser. Now, another iconic moment is one of the most memorable lines from cinema history. Well, how iconic is it? Well, even those of you that haven't seen this movie, you'll know which line I'm talking about. All I need to say is, "Do you expect me to talk?" "No, Mr. Bond. You know the line, I expect you to die." It's a great line. Very iconic. Absolutely iconic. However, I remember when I saw this movie as a teenager, I was bothered by a seeming plot hole. It occurs when the laser is approaching his crotch, and he says, "If I fail to report, 008 replaces me." And the Goldfinger says, "Well, I trust he will be more successful." "Well, he knows what I know." And Goldfinger answers, "You know nothing." And Bond says, "Operation Grand Slam, for instance." And Goldfinger says, "You know, two words you may have overheard, which cannot have the slightest significance to you or anyone in your organization." And Bond says, "Can you afford to take that chance?" And Goldfinger talks to one of his men and finally decides to turn off the laser. And he says, "You are quite right, Mr. Bond. You are worth more to me alive." And sure, it's a great scene and it shows Bond's ability to talk himself out of a situation. And it just shows how clever Bond is. But if you really think about it, does it really make sense? Why doesn't Goldfinger just cut Bond in half with the laser? I mean, how is Bond worth more to him alive? And I assumed that I was young and I was naive and maybe I simply wasn't old enough or smart enough to get it. So I let it go. But I have to admit, you know, as an adult I'm watching this, I'm still not convinced this isn't a plot hole. After all, what does this mean, that he's going to allow 007 to report, you know, in? I mean, isn't that more dangerous? Or is having a new agent, presumably 008, investigate Grand Slam any more dangerous for Goldfinger if 007 is alive or dead? After all, wouldn't that imply that MI6 already knows of the plan? And isn't it then more dangerous to keep 007 alive? And much less alive and roaming free inside his operation? So, I've heard theories, but I'm not convinced. I am absolutely convinced that this is a plot hole. But I get it. I have to still suspend my disbelief and enjoy the ride. And it is still one heck of a ride. Well, let's talk about how this movie was made. So, in this third installment, director Terrence Young turned down the chance to direct the third Bond movie. Apparently, Terrence Young wanted a percentage of Goldfinger's profits, which I think may be reasonable considering he basically created the franchise. But you know how Hollywood producers are. They said no. So he left and went on to direct a movie called The Amorous Adventures of Moll Flanders. The producers went with Guy Hamilton. And Guy Hamilton was originally Broccoli and Saltzman's first choice to direct Dr. No, but this time he accepted the job. Hamilton's first mission was to create a worthy villain. He felt that Bond needed to be less of a Superman and more vulnerable, and he felt that by creating a more powerful and threatening villain would be exactly what the franchise needed, and he was right. Goldfinger and his henchman Oddjob are considered two of the greatest Bond villains of all time, and when we see them, we largely do fear for Bond's life. For the main villain, Ari Goldfinger, the producers wanted Orson Welles, but Orson Welles' salary demands were way too high, so they went with German actor Gert Frobe. But Frobe couldn't speak English, so all of his dialogue was dubbed by an English actor named Michael Collins. So the actor Gert Frobe had to phonetically mouth his dialogue, you know, kind of in pantomime. Unfortunately, since the actor couldn't speak any English, he apparently had a lot of trouble with this, and you know, they had to continue to redo the scenes because he was not mouthing the words up properly. Now, Guy Hamilton saw a professional wrestler, Harold Sakata, in a professional wrestling venue and considered him for the role of Oddjob. And he was fascinated by this weird way that Harold Sakata moved and thought that it might look great on film. And you can see these odd movements, the way he walks and fights in the film. Well, Saltzman and Broccoli loved his physical presence, and they hired him immediately. And Guy Hamilton apparently really liked Harold Sakata and considered him an absolute gentleman and said that he was very, very professional. And the on-screen character of Oddjob was basically created using Harold Sakata's physicality as the template. And, of course, Oddjob is now considered one of the most memorable villains in all of cinema. Probably everyone's favorite Bond villain, second only to Jaws in The Spy Who Loved Me. For the role of Pussy Galore, the producers wanted Honor Blackman and went to her for the role, which she accepted. Honor Blackman was already famous as Kathy Gale in The Avengers, not the Marvel comic, but the James Bond-esque TV series with Patrick McNee as the bowler-wearing John Steed, who always has a beautiful female partner. She accepted the role as Pussy Galore and left the show and was replaced by Diana Rigg, who'd go on to play the iconic partner, Emma Peel. Now, Diana Rigg would also get to play a Bond girl in Her Majesty's Secret Service. As a humorous reference to this, in one episode, John Steed and Emma Peel actually get a postcard from Kathy Gale, who says she's having a great time at Fort Knox. Now, apparently, the producers were concerned that the name wouldn't pass the censors and actually considered changing the name Pussy Galore to Kitty Galore. Instead, they decided to play a little bit of politics. The producers apparently took the American censor and his wife out to dinner, wined and dined him, and they knew that the American censor was a loyal member of the Republican Party, so the producers talked about how much they were Republicans and how much they hated Lyndon Johnson, and eventually they made friends with him. And apparently it worked. The American censors actually backed off. They allowed use of the name Pussy Galore in the movie as long as they would not use a name in any advertisement, posters, or commercials. In Ian Fleming's original novel, Goldfinger, Pussy Galore was a lesbian, which is why she gave Bond the cold shoulder when they first met. The character of Pussy Galore was actually based on Ian Fleming's girlfriend on the island, Blanche Blackwell. As for the name Pussy Galore, well, it turns out it was actually a little more than just a double entendre dirty name. Apparently, there was a famous spy named Pussy Deacon. She was a legendary linguist who spoke multiple languages and was a very renowned spy during World War II. Ian Fleming not only named Pussy Galore after her, but also his pet octopus named Pussy, which he eventually would call Octopussy in his future short story, Octopussy, which was later turned into a movie starring Roger Moore and Maude Adams. Jack Lord, who played Felix Leiter in Dr. No, was asked to play Felix Leiter again, but he turned it down, and he was replaced by a different actor, actually a professional character actor named Seck Linder. And this would begin the tradition of having different actors play Felix Leiter in every movie. In fact, only two actors, David Hedison and Jeffrey Wright, had played Felix Leiter in two movies. David Hedison played Felix in Live and Let Die, and again in License to Kill, and Jeffrey Wright is the only actor to play him in two back-to-back movies, Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. Well, how did this movie do? This movie, made on a budget of $3 million, which was the combined budget of both Dr. No and From Russia with Love, went on to be a huge hit, both a box office and critical success. It actually made so much money in its initial release, it was actually entered into the Guinness Book of World Records at the time for the fastest box office earnings. It went on to make $43 million worldwide in its first release, and ultimately $125 million in the reissue. And that's $548 million in 2013 dollars when adjusted for inflation. Furthermore, it is considered one of the best James Bond films, and the historical moment when James Bond became a true phenomenon. Prior to the release of Goldfinger in 1964, there were only one or two espionage movies a year. This movie is going to just explode that trend. And 2 years after its release, in 1966, Hollywood released 22 espionage films. Goldfinger is rated number 71 in the AFI 100 Greatest Films. And Entertainment Weekly, which recently came out with a ranking of all the Bond films in their Skyfall issue, rated Goldfinger the number one Bond film. Also, elements of this film have been homaged and spoofed in hundreds of films, including The Simpsons, you know, Austin Powers. The third movie is called Austin Powers Goldmember. It's been spoofed in True Lies, as I said, that opening sequence when he takes off the scuba gear and he's wearing a tuxedo. And there's just numerous, numerous references where this movie is homaged or parodied. So we see history absolutely being cemented here. So even with this plot hole, this is just an excellent, excellent movie. Well, that ends my podcast. Please tune in next week where we will talk about the fourth James Bond movie, Thunderball. I thank listeners so much for tuning into our podcast, and I want to remind listeners that the absolute best way to listen to this episode is to subscribe for free on iTunes. This way, you can download all new episodes automatically and get them downloaded onto your iPod so that you can listen to these podcasts, you know, while driving in your car or stuck in rush hour traffic. So that ends this podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you had a great time.